A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how modern militaries and police forces use dogs beyond the classic drug and explosive sniffing we all picture. When you hear military working dog, you probably think of a German shepherd at an airport checkpoint. But Daniel's pointing at the whole iceberg beneath that. Dogs clearing buildings, parachuting from helicopters, tracking a specific person's scent across miles hours after they passed. The question is really, what do these animals actually do in the field? And why are we still using them when we've got drones and sensors and AI?
It's a sharper question than most people realize, because the answer keeps getting more interesting, not less. The U.S. Military Working Dog Program got formalized in 1942 during World War II, but the roles today look nothing like what those early dogs did. The 341st Training Squadron at Lackland Air Force Base now trains over 1,000 dogs annually for every branch. And these aren't just detection animals. They're doing patrol, attack, tracking, sentry scout, and combat assault missions. Some of them wear body armor with cameras and GPS. Some jump out of aircraft.
The dog at the checkpoint is basically the receptionist. We're talking about the ones kicking down doors.
That's the episode. And I want to start with something that doesn't get said enough. Dogs have a sensory package that no technology has fully replicated. A dog's nose has up to 300 million olfactory receptors. Humans have about 6 million. They can detect scent at concentrations of parts per trillion. And they do it while moving at 30 miles an hour through chaotic environments where sensors fail and radios drop out. That's not a sentimental argument. That's an engineering reality.
Right. And that gap between what a dog can do and what our best hardware can do is the whole reason these roles exist. So let's start with the roles that actually put dogs in harm's way. Patrol, attack, and combat assault.
Patrol and attack dogs are what the military calls frontline dogs. Their job is to apprehend suspects, clear buildings, and deliver force, lethal or non-lethal, on command. The training pipeline is intense. It starts with basic obedience, then moves into controlled aggression. The dog has to learn to engage a target on command, and, critically, to disengage on command. That's the part most people don't understand. These aren't just angry dogs. They're trained to bite and release with precision. A patrol dog that won't release on command is a liability, not an asset.
It's not sick the dog on someone. It's a graduated force option.
The bite work is calibrated. Dogs are trained to target limbs, to hold rather than maul, and to stop the instant the handler gives the release command. After that comes scenario-based training. Building clearing, vehicle extraction, crowd control. They run drills where the dog has to distinguish between a fleeing suspect and a panicked civilian. That's non-trivial. The dog has to read the handler's body language, voice commands, and the tactical context all at once.
The breed of choice for this is the Belgian Malinois, right? Not the German Shepherd.
The Malinois is lighter, faster, and has higher endurance than a Shepherd. They're also more. A Malinois doesn't have an off switch the way some other breeds do. For a patrol role where you need sustained high alertness, that's an advantage. For a family pet, it's a nightmare. The special operations community has largely switched to Malinois. Cairo, the dog that participated in the 2011 Navy SEAL raid that killed Osama bin Laden, was a Belgian Malinois.
Cairo is the one everyone points to. But what did he actually do on that raid?
He was a combat assault dog, the most extreme role. Trained for helicopter insertion, fast roping, and room clearing. He went in ahead of the team to detect anyone hiding or fleeing. He wore body armor, a night vision compatible camera, and a communication earpiece so the handler could give commands remotely. The dog was literally first through the door in some scenarios. That's not a mascot, that's a tactical asset.
You've got a dog rappelling from a helicopter in body armor with a camera feed. At what point do we just admit we've built a furry soldier?
Yet the military legally classifies them as equipment. We'll get to that, but the combat assault role is worth sitting with for a second. These dogs train for airborne operations. They jump with handlers, they fast rope, they're conditioned to the noise and chaos of rotor wash and gunfire. Some wear gas masks. The vests they wear now have integrated cameras, microphones, and GPS trackers that stream real-time data back to the handler and to command. The handler can see what the dog sees. That's a level of situational awareness that's hard to get any other way in a dark building.
What about the sentry and scout roles? Those feel different from the direct action stuff.
They are, and they're arguably where dogs provide the most irreplaceable value. Sentry dogs are posted at checkpoints, perimeters, and forward operating bases. Their job is to alert the handler to intruders or ambushes. A sentry dog will detect someone approaching long before a human sentry will, by scent, by sound, by subtle changes in the environment. They're a force multiplier for guard duty. One handler and one dog can secure a perimeter that would otherwise require multiple personnel. Scout dogs work ahead of patrols. This is where the Vietnam-era examples get striking. The U.S. Marine Corps used scout dogs extensively in Vietnam. The dogs would walk point, ahead of the lead Marine, and silently indicate enemy forces, booby traps, or snipers. They didn't bark, because barking gives away position. They used body language, a stiffened posture, a raised tail, a specific look back at the handler. That silent communication system, developed through months of bonding and training, saved hundreds of lives by detecting ambushes before they were sprung.
A dog's body language as an encrypted tactical signal. That's a wild thought.
It's also something no drone can replicate. A drone can give you overhead imagery, but it can't walk through jungle undergrowth and smell the faint trace of a human who passed through an hour ago. A scout dog can. And the handler learns to read the dog's signals with a granularity that's almost telepathic. A slight change in ear position might mean something's off. A particular head tilt might mean human scent, close. These pairs train together for months before deployment. The bond is the interface.
Let's talk about tracking and trailing, because that's the one that sounds like magic to me. A dog following a specific person's scent across miles, hours later?
It's distinct from air scenting, which is what search and rescue dogs do. They catch a general human scent on the wind and follow it to the source. Tracking and trailing dogs follow a specific individual scent. Every human sheds skin cells constantly, about 40,000 per minute. Those cells carry a unique chemical signature, diet, hormones, medications, genetics. The dog locks onto that signature and follows it. They can track across pavement, through water, in urban environments where the scent gets scattered by traffic and air currents. No technology comes close to this.
What's the time window on that? How old can a trail be?
It depends on conditions, weather, terrain, contamination, but dogs have successfully tracked trails that were 24 to 48 hours old. In a military context, that means you can find enemy combatants who passed through an area a day ago or locate missing personnel. Police use this for fugitive tracking. The dog gets a scent article, a piece of clothing, a car seat, and works from there. It's not infallible, but it's reliable enough that it's standard procedure in manhunts.
This is where the just use a drone argument completely falls apart. A drone can't smell yesterday.
A drone can give you a heat signature if the person is still there. But if they left 12 hours ago, the drone sees nothing. The dog reads a chemical history that's invisible to every sensor we have. That's the irreplaceable bit. Now let's shift to how technology and ethics are changing the field, because that's where things get complicated.
Before we do, you mentioned the training pipeline earlier. What's the actual throughput? How many dogs are we talking about?
The 341st Training Squadron at Lackland runs the Defense Department's Military Working Dog Program. They train over 1,000 dogs a year for all branches. The dogs come from a dedicated breeding program and from select vendors, mostly in Europe. The cost to fully train one military working dog is somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000, depending on specialization. That's actually cheap compared to a lot of military hardware. But the lead time is significant. You can't ramp up production the way you can with drones.
A drone factory can double output in 6 months. A dog breeding program takes years.
Each dog is paired with a handler who goes through the training alongside the animal. That handler dog team is the operational unit. If the handler rotates out, the dog has to bond with a new handler, which takes time and doesn't always work. If the dog is killed, the handler often experiences something closer to losing a partner than losing a piece of gear, which brings us to the legal classification.
They're legally equipment.
Under U.S. law, military working dogs are classified as equipment, not personnel, not even a special category. That means no legal protections like those afforded to soldiers. No Purple Heart for a dog wounded in action, though there have been informal awards. No rank, though handlers traditionally give their dogs an honorary rank one grade above their own, so the handler has to treat the dog with the respect due a superior. That's a custom, not a regulation.
Wait, the dog outranks the handler.
By tradition, yes. It's partly a joke and partly a genuine reminder that the handler serves the team and the dog deserves respect. But legally, the dog is a piece of government property. And that classification has real consequences for retirement, medical care, and what happens when the dog can no longer work.
Robbie's Law changed some of that, right?
Robbie's Law, passed in 2000, allowed retired military working dogs to be adopted by former handlers and civilians. Before that, they were often euthanized at the end of their service life, treated like surplus equipment. Robbie's Law was a direct response to advocacy from handlers who had bonded with their dogs and were horrified that the animal who saved their life would be put down when it couldn't work anymore. Today, there's a waiting list to adopt retired military working dogs. The U.S. War Dogs Association helps facilitate placements.
The handler, who spent 2 years trusting this animal with their life, watches it get treated like a broken radio. That's a special kind of institutional cruelty.
It's changing, but slowly. There's advocacy to reclassify military working dogs as canine veterans with corresponding benefits and protections. Nothing has passed yet. The resistance is partly bureaucratic inertia and partly concern about precedent. If dogs get personnel status, what about other working animals? But the argument from handlers is straightforward. This animal took rounds for me. It deserves better than a disposal form.
Let's talk about the police side. You mentioned some departments training dogs for electronic detection. That sounds like sci-fi.
It's real, and it's one of the most interesting developments in police canine work. Several departments in Oregon and Washington have trained dogs to detect electronic storage devices. SD cards, hard drives, USB sticks, even micro SD cards that are practically invisible to the human eye. These devices contain a chemical compound called triphenylphosphine oxide, or TPPO, which is used in the manufacturing of circuit boards. Dogs can detect it. So, in child exploitation and cybercrime investigations, where suspects hide tiny storage devices in walls, under floorboards, inside other electronics, the dog can find evidence that a physical search would miss.
A dog sniffing out a micro SD card hidden in a wall outlet. That's absurdly specific.
It's led to convictions that would otherwise have been impossible. The digital evidence dog is a niche but growing specialty. Another emerging area is fentanyl and synthetic opioid detection. These substances are odorless to humans, but dogs can be trained to alert on them, critical for interdiction at borders and in prisons, where fentanyl smuggling has become a major problem.
The detection rules are actually expanding, not shrinking. It's not just drugs and bombs anymore. It's digital forensics and synthetic chemistry.
Crowd control, which is more controversial. Police canines are used for suspect apprehension, the bite and hold we talked about, but also for dispersing crowds and establishing a visible deterrent presence. The optics of a police dog lunging at protesters are terrible, and there's a long and ugly history of dogs being used as weapons of intimidation, particularly against civil rights marchers in the 60s. That history shapes the debate today. Departments are more careful about deployment, but the tension is inherent. A dog trained to apprehend is a use of force, and force can be misused.
That's where the training quality matters enormously. A well-trained dog will release on command. A poorly trained one won't. And the difference can be a lawsuit or a fatality.
There's also the question of breed-specific legislation. Some jurisdictions ban or restrict breeds commonly used in canine work, pit bulls, Malinois, shepherds, which creates conflicts between police departments and local ordinances. The counter-argument from canine advocates is that these dogs are selected and trained to a standard that makes breed generalizations irrelevant. A police Malinois is not a random Malinois. It's a $100,000 investment with a documented training record.
The "my dog is different" argument, but with actual receipts.
Now, let's talk about where this is all heading, because the technology side is accelerating. Modern tactical vests for military dogs have cameras, microphones, GPS, and in some cases two-way audio, so the handler can give commands from a distance. Some dogs are being trained to trigger remote sensors, run to a door, drop a listening device, return. Others carry small payloads like communication relays or medical supplies. The dog becomes a delivery platform.
A furry drone with teeth.
That framing is uncomfortable for a lot of people, but it's accurate. The question is whether dogs eventually get replaced by actual drones and robots. Boston Dynamics has Spot, the quadruped robot. It can carry cameras, navigate terrain, even open doors. But it can't smell. It can't track a scent trail. It can't read human body language or make split-second threat assessments. And it costs $75,000 with a battery life measured in minutes, not hours.
The dog's sensory package and endurance keep it relevant.
But the gap is narrowing in some areas. Drones are getting better at autonomous navigation. AI-powered cameras can do threat detection. Robotic platforms are getting cheaper and more capable. The question isn't whether dogs will be replaced entirely. It's which roles persist and which get automated. My bet, scent-based roles. Tracking, trailing, electronic detection are safe for decades. Patrol and sentry roles might get augmented or partially replaced by sensor networks and drones. Combat assault is the wild card because that's where the ethical questions are sharpest.
Sending a robot into a building first is an easy call. Sending a dog is harder. Sending a person is hardest. The dog sits in a weird ethical middle ground.
That's where the equipment classification becomes practically convenient for the military. If a robot is destroyed, it's a budget line item. If a dog is killed, it's also a budget line item, legally. But the handler doesn't experience it that way, and that disconnect creates real psychological harm. There are handlers with PTSD specifically from losing their dog in combat. The military is slowly acknowledging this, but the legal framework hasn't caught up.
What does all this mean for someone listening? Whether they're in law enforcement or military procurement, or just a civilian trying to understand what their tax dollars are buying.
First, for anyone in procurement or operational planning, dogs are not a replacement for technology, and technology is not a replacement for dogs. They're complementary. Dogs excel in ambiguity and close quarters where sensors fail and communication is degraded. Drones and robots excel in persistence and expendability. The smart approach is to deploy them together. A drone provides overwatch while a scout dog works the ground, or a robot clears the first room while the dog clears the second. Don't think of it as either or. Understanding these roles matters for policy debates. When your city council discusses the police canine budget, or when there's an incident involving a police dog, knowing the difference between a patrol dog and a detection dog, and between controlled apprehension and excessive force, makes you a more informed participant. It also matters for breed-specific legislation. A blanket ban on Malinois might prevent a police department from acquiring a dog that could find a missing child or detect a hidden hard drive in an exploitation case.
There's also the advocacy angle. You mentioned the U.S. War Dogs Association.
They're one of several organizations that support retired military and police working dogs, funding medical care, facilitating adoptions, and pushing for legal reforms. Canine retirement funds exist at the local level too. If someone listening wants to do something concrete, supporting those organizations is a direct way to acknowledge that these animals served, even if the law still calls them equipment.
The legal status fight, is that actually moving anywhere?
There have been bills introduced, but nothing has passed at the federal level. The argument that's gaining traction is that the current classification is not just morally wrong, but operationally counterproductive. It makes it harder to retain handlers, it complicates retirement and medical care, and it creates a legal gray area around liability when a dog is injured or killed. The practical case might win where the moral case hasn't.
The dog is simultaneously a precision instrument, a loyal partner, and a piece of gear on a spreadsheet. That's the tension.
It's not going away. As AI and robotics advance, we're going to face weirder versions of this question. If we genetically select dogs for enhanced olfactory capability, are they still dogs? If we augment them with cybernetic implants, and there are research programs looking at this, what's the legal status then? A dog with a neural interface is still a living creature, but it's also a platform. The line gets blurry fast.
The cyborg dog conversation is not one I expected to have today, but here we are.
It's the logical endpoint of treating animals as tactical assets. If you can make the asset better with technology, you will. The question is whether the law and the ethics can keep up.
One thing I keep coming back to is the scent tracking. Everything else, the cameras, the body armor, the fast roping, that's impressive, but it's additive. The scent capability is the one thing that's genuinely unique. We can build machines that move faster and hit harder. We can't build a machine that smells yesterday.
That's why I think dogs stay relevant for a long time. The sensory gap is real, and it's not closing quickly. Electronic noses exist, but they're bulky, slow, and can't match the sensitivity or the real-time processing that a dog's olfactory system does. A dog doesn't just detect a scent. It interprets it, tracks it, and makes decisions about it, all while navigating terrain at speed. That's an integrated sensor fusion package that would cost millions to replicate and still wouldn't fit on a drone.
The dog is, in a very real sense, the most advanced piece of equipment in the inventory. And also legally a toaster.
That's the episode, really.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the coronation of King George V in 1911, the acoustic properties of Westminster Abbey created an unexpected reverberation pattern that caused the choir's Zadok the Priest to echo for a full 7 seconds after the final note, a phenomenon later measured by scientists on the Chatham Islands who detected the same resonant frequency in a local sea cave and used it to calibrate early hydrophone equipment.
I have so many questions, and I'm choosing to ask none of them.
That's the correct call. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtob, whose fact-checking process remains a mystery to everyone, including himself. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.